Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate y'all taking time today to join us for another live edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that is listening live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you will see a link to the chat room. That's the place where you can, if you have some observations you want to share, you can roll in there and make them. Are there some questions you would like for us to address during the course of the show? That's a great place to do it as well. And if you have to head off and take care of some business and you want to catch up on the parts that you missed, remember the best shortcut you can do is go ahead and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spreaker, or any of the other aggregating sites you may get your podcast from. That way, you'll not only be able to get the full archive of this show, but be able to catch all the previous shows you may have missed. Now, let's go ahead and roll in to the rest of the show. Almost everybody who follows military issues can clearly point to the Army Reserve, the National Guard, the Air Force Reserve, even the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve when they deploy its units and its individuals. But more often than not, especially during the course of the Long War, our Naval Reserve has been hard to track and keep hold of. They're out there every day. Thousands are deployed. And what we want to do today is not just shine a light on that, but to talk a bit about how our nation is utilizing their reserves, what's the best way we think they could be utilized, and going forward as our nation tries to reset from the better part of a decade and a half of ground wars, what we could better do to have our Naval Reserve serve the United States Navy, where its people come from and signed up to serve to begin with. And our guest to discuss these and related issues today will be Chris Raleigh, Captain, United States Naval Reserve, and Claude Barabé, Lieutenant Commander, USNR. Chris is the CEO, his full-time SID job, of Harvest Returns. It's a platform for investing in agriculture. And for his reserve gig, he is the Chief of Staff for Commander Naval Surface Forces, Reserve Chief, that is. And Dr. Claude Barabé, he teaches at the U.S. Naval Academy, and he recently returned from his third deployment as an officer in the United States Naval Reserve. And it's kind of a kicking off point for today's show. If you haven't already, we'll provide a link to it over in the chat room. But if you go to War on the Rocks and look up All Sane Men Believe in Reserves, that's an article that Claude put out last month that we'll use as a starting point for our talk. Claude and Chris, welcome to Midrat.
Great to be here, Sal.
Thank you very much.
I think just to start off today's show, because I think it's always good to give people an opportunity to hear about somebody's latest deployment. Claude, you've probably got the Caribbean funk out of your clothes by now, but if you could update the listener on where you as a Naval Reserve officer just came back from a deployment, what you did, and maybe some of the revelations you had during the course of your deployment when it comes to reserves.
Sure. I was in a station at Joint Task Force Guantanamo Bay for 9 months, and I just recently returned. I, for the most part, served as the Deputy J2 or the Deputy Director of Intelligence at JTF Gitmo. And I think what people tend to forget is when they talk about Gitmo in the news or elsewhere is that it's actually a base that we have been at for more than 100 years, an area that we got as a result of the Spanish-American War. Some of my observations obviously can't discuss that part of the job that I did. But I did work with the Coast Guard Reserve, the North Maritime Security Detachment, just first rate people. There are CVs stated there, medical personnel, all reservists. In fact, the majority of Navy personnel there are reservists. I also got a chance to work with the folks on the base itself, which is on the southeast of Cuba.
And Claude, you were fading in and out a bit. You may want to, or if you want to, we could call you back on your backup phone line. You're breaking up just a little bit there. So anyway, if you want to try calling back in, we got about 80% of it, but was a little bit choppy. So Chris, while Claude resets his primary communications path, I wanted to roll over to you to talk a little bit about, as the Reserve Chief of Staff for Commander Naval Surface Forces, that's usually, and we're going to touch on this a bit as we go through the show, but you know, there are a lot of misconceptions that, you know, Naval Reserve is all naval stuff. And as we'll talk during the course of the show, that a lot of joint billets are being filled by the Navy Reserve. Talk for a little bit, though, about Naval Surface Forces and the surface warfare community in the Naval Reserve and how they work in that component.
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. So we've got, in my current role as the Reserve Chief of Staff, I kind of heard reins on 3,800 folks that are supporting Naval Surface Forces afloat and ashore. And that's a lot of different types of capabilities. It includes our about 1,000, almost 1,000 sailors assigned to your favorite ship type, LCS Ron 1 and 2. We've got people in the amphibious construction battalions, beachmaster units, assault craft units, that expeditionary flavor. In the headquarter units, we send out people that do maintenance on board ships. We send out afloat chaplains for ministry support. We do something called the Afloat Culture Workshop. And we've got a new capability with our strategic sea lift officers. That's guys that used to be called sea chicken, for those that have been around a while. But our SSOs are a great capability. These are actively sailing, in most cases, civilian mariners, commissioned officers. And we are sending these guys out to surface ships to do bridge resource management workshops. And basically, they go out to a ship, ride a ship for about a week or so, work with the CO and the watchstanding teams to help those build and maintain proficiency in navigation and seamanship. And that, so that is sort of an outcome of the 2017 collisions that most of your listeners are probably familiar with on Fitzgerald and John McCain. So that's a little bit of what we do. My other hat is the Chief of Staff for the Surface Warfare Reserve Enterprise Executive Committee. And there we keep all the SWOs sort of level set information between the various 1115, that's Surface Warfare Officer Designator. We've got not only the Surface Warfare folks, but Coastal Riverine Squadron, Military Sealift Command. And then we do things like Health of the Force, which is mentoring, recruiting JOs as they come off active duty to retain them into the reserve force and communications and that sort of thing. So that all keeps me busy. It's my first sort of man train equip job after doing close to 20 years operational. So it's a nice change of pace.
Well, I think one thing we should start off with here that we forgot was that neither you nor Claude are speaking on behalf of any part of the Department of Defense, United States Navy, or the organizations to which you may or may not belong, but are speaking as individuals. And that being said, the reserves are not as large an organization as many people think. Out of the people who get paid on the weekends, the selective reserves, how many bodies are we talking about? And is there a need for more of them?
Eagle One, I think I can get that. If you can hear me, okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're coming through fine.
Yeah, you're
okay.
You're fine.
All right, thanks. So in the cell res, selected reserve, we've got 49,000. That's about 13,000 officers, 36,000 enlisted. In the IR, individual ready reserve, about 51,000.
And of those, even some of those have gone on mobilizations or other types of long-term orders like ADT or ADSW, it's additional duty for special work. So all told, about 100,000. But the IR very rarely drills, goes on mobilizations or anything. So you're really talking about the cell res. And then you've got another 10,000 who are FTS, the full-time support. It used to be the TARS.
And Claude, one of the point everybody to a couple of things that you brought up in your article that we referenced before over at War on the Rocks. It's interesting because we've had shows on Midras before when we've talked about reserves and a little more close to home for you and Chris actually, you know, being in the reserves. But the whole Hamlet-like discussion about the Navy and its relationship to the reserves, it's not something really that's new to this decade or really this generation. And you outlined all the way back to the 1920s the question about do we need a Naval Reserve and what's it for? When you were reviewing that history of articles and questions and discussions, is there a common thread between them? And have you seen the argument change any over the course of the years?
Yeah, I did. So when I started writing it, I was actually thinking of Admiral Stockdale, you know, one of the great American naval heroes from the Vietnam War. But I was really thinking about a couple of questions he asked during the 1992 vice presidential candidates debate. And if you recall, he started off saying, "Who am I? Why am I here?" And unfortunately, Saturday Night Live did a parody of that. But Admiral Stockdale was a brilliant man and knew that at the heart, those are the questions you have to ask for anything, whether it's on politics, on the military, or personal philosophy. So I just started asking, who are we? Why are we here? And the approach that I took for this particular article was, number one, as you mentioned, I looked at the validity of asking the question, because as I was researching the articles that Naval Reserve and active duty officers had written for really more than 100 years, they were asking that same question from time to time. And then the article goes in, for those who haven't had a chance to read it, really into the history of the reserves for the past 100 years. The third part is what's changed since 9/11, and fourth, what do we need to do? I think the common theme I saw until 9/11, was the Navy Reserve was a very platform-based support element. They were initially during World War One, and even 30 years before, when some sort of Naval Reserve service was first proposed by naval officers to provide manpower on those ships. If there were other ships in the reserve, they could fully man those. During World War II, for example, something like 90% of Navy personnel were reserves. The same was true for a lot of small boats, destroyer escorts, auxiliary support crafts, submarines were actually commanded by reservists. You couldn't obviously do that today with destroyers, cruisers, et cetera. But that what changed was 9/11. And we, by necessity, as then Secretary Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the military you have, not the military you wish you had. And as a result of that, the Navy Reserve got drawn up into the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where a lot of them were serving there rather than on ships. And in fact, since 9/11, it's been a rarity. And Chris can counter certainly with his data, but the norm has been to serve ashore and in joint billets, arguably in Army-like billets. There are some exceptions. The Riverine squadrons that Chris mentioned drill together. They deploy together. There are a few billets available on ships, but again, few and far between. There are some aviation platforms that are strictly reserves. CAQ-209 is one I mentioned in the article. So what's changed is we have gone from a Navy-focused mission for the Navy Reserve to a joint mission. And the irony is that in wars like Iraq, Afghanistan, where it is primarily land-based, and there obviously we have support from carriers, et cetera. But in a primarily land-based war, you're going to see the Navy there in joint billets. The question then becomes, in a primarily sea battle, maritime conflict, are we going to then see Army personnel supporting any kind of naval operations? I think we saw just a couple of months ago, there was an article about the Army it was an article in G Captain that they were going to divest a majority of their watercraft and maritime capability. And that was pointed out to me by Twitter user Joe Petroselli. I should note that. But when I'm reading this article, like, they refer to themselves as maritime soldiers or mariners. So that's it, mariner soldiers. And I was really struck by that because it was about the same time that I was writing this article about how the Navy Reserve is simply becoming Army light. So over to Chris on that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with what Claude said, and I know when he was working on his article, we talked a little bit. But we do have reservists out at sea on USS ships and military sealift command ships, sometimes in leadership positions on any given day, all around the world. So the main reason we're still fighting ashore and deploying ashore is because that's where the presidential recall that was stood up after or passed after 9/11 and is still in effect. That's the guidance under which we're mobilizing people, and we're mobilizing them still in support of GWAT, OCO, whatever you want to call the fight against jihadi terrorism that's still going on around the world. And so the vast majority of our billets are supporting that fight. And would another presidential recall be passed for future conflicts? And, of course, I'm sure we would see reservists wherever our country wants them to deploy. And there's a constant sort of yin and yang, and we talk about this quite a bit, between the operational – is the Navy Reserve an operational force or is it strategic force? Are we doing day-to-day operations, or are we waiting for the next big war to happen? And my personal answer to this is both. You know, is sort of disjointed as that is, we have to do both. If you look at – go out across any of the number of fleets right now, look at any sort of joint or Navy-centric exercise, you're going to have reservists out there deployed. And most reservists have done a lot of that these past 20 years, in addition to going to the sandbox, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Horn of Africa, or down at Gitmo, plus several other places.
Yeah, it seemed to me that when I was active in the reserves, we had some units that existed only because they were Navy missions that the active component did not want to do because they didn't need to do it all the time. It took up manpower and money, and the reserves could do it. And for example, in the old days, the Navy control of shipping, now Navy control, Navy something, coordination and guides of shipping, whatever it is.
Right.
And the mobile inshore undersea warfare units, and a lot of the other there were a few other hardware units, and some of the cargo battalions and stuff. They were reserved, but it was a mission that the reserves could do and would be ready to go, because as you said about the riverine forces, they got called up as units and deployed that way. Are there unique missions that the reserve should be doing that they're unable to do because we keep sending bodies off to do staff work in Afghanistan, or are we able to do all the things we need to do? Is that ever possible for a reserve force?
That's a really good question, Eagle One, because I won't speak for the SOAR community because we've got an expert with Chris here, but from the intelligence community, we're heavily invested in individual augmentees, and so you can drill with your naval intelligence unit for 2 years. You can drill as a team with exercises for a couple of years, but it's very unlikely that you will be mobilized to ONI or to another intelligence activity as a team. There are very few places like that. I mean, even after 9/11, when we were kind of I happened to be at ONI on 9/11 and on my 2 weeks of AT, and so we all just volunteered from there and got on the active duty as soon as possible. But again, that's not the norm, and so I think what we have to do is revisit what we are doing on the weekends and throughout the year and for our ATs, and who are we supporting, whether that's the intelligence community or other communities. You have basically 192 hours during a year of drill weekend time. And when you take that time away from, you take subtract time for the physical readiness test, for general military training, all the online or face-to-face training we do, admin, medical, defense travel system, et cetera, you know, I kind of calculated out, we get about 80 to 90 hours per year of supporting a gaining command with those few hours. And so how can we better support either a gaining command, or do we have to take a much broader look at how the Navy reserves are used, whether that's the intelligence community or one of the other communities, in terms of supporting somebody else? If it's unlikely you're going to be deploying with people that you have trained with for a couple of years. Do we need to set a new standard where we simply abolish those kind of support missions and find something else? And what I have found, and what I pointed out in the article, is that there are a whole lot of reservists out there who are not in tune with maritime operations. Most of the folks like Chris have been prior SWOs, but there's a whole community out there, the direct commission officer community, of which I was one. We have enlisted who came in direct to their Navy Reserve, almost all of them, and I would love to see a survey on this, have never served on a ship. I was lucky. I got 6 months deployment on the USS Bunker Hill as a Sea Combat Commander N2 a number of years ago, and it was a great experience. And what I valued, and I wish that we could provide to other reservists, particularly intel reservists, is I spent time on the bridge as a conning officer, standing the watch, learning about ship operations, understanding what the SWOs needed for me because they were my customer. But I also spent a lot of time in the LSO shack watching helicopter operations. I had our air boss was a fantastic officer who showed me around the helicopters, helped me understand their operations more so that I could better serve them, particularly when we went to Sumatra after as a result of the tsunami for humanitarian relief operations. So I think when the intelligence community is asked to look at potential peer competitors from a maritime perspective, and we have to assess their capabilities and what they're doing, all right, what are we basing that on? Again, I'm fortunate there's a lot of folks who have served on ships prior to entering the reserves who have that shipboard experience. But if you haven't been there, if you haven't studied how our operations work, how can you then, what's the baseline you use for studying other navies?
And Chris, that's a perfect lead in that Claude gave us. A question I wanted to roll your way, because We've been around a few years, especially like my co-host, but it wasn't too long ago.
Ouch.
That, well, you know, the kids nowadays, a lot of stuff, you have to remind ourselves that the guys going in front of their command screen boards right now got their commission after 9/11. They don't remember the 80s or the 90s. And back when I was a wee little J.O., we had significant units in the Naval Reserves. We even had a Naval Reserve Air Wing, a lot more seagoing units. And the larger naval conversation has gone towards getting ready for peer, near-peer competitor. And at sea, that is a big war. I know Claude addressed this point in his article, that you know, history is replete with brilliant people talking about how the next war will be a short one. That is a fool's promise if history teaches us nothing. And I've always thought that the one sad thing that we see in the reserves is the Navy has invested a lot of time and taxpayer money in creating a lot of human capital on active duty people, and a lot of active duty people leave active duty. They've done their service. They go on. And all that human capital investment, there's really no place in the Naval Reserve to recapture that experience. It's the same way that the Army Reserve does, the U.S. Air Force Reserve especially. Is there a way that we could better refocus without, of course, billions and billions and billions of additional dollars, to refocus how we look at the utilization of our Naval Reserve to better recapture that investment in human capital that we're making?
Yeah, we can always do better, Sal. I think one thing that's important to point out is, so I've been a reservist, I guess, about 20 years ago. I left active duty thereabouts. And my entire career up until very recently, reserve career up until very recently, we've been downsizing. So as you mentioned, we did have a lot of these capabilities. And, you know, due to various budget cuts, we shrunk and we truncated some of those capabilities and eliminated others. And we're finally starting to see some in-strength growth. You know, one of my sort of tertiary things is sort of watching the reserve POM process, at least how it affects the surface Navy and seeing those new billets and those new capabilities we're bringing on board. And it's always going to be just like the big Navy's doing. We're always going to be looking to optimize our manpower. But I will, you know, just one example, Aegis fire controlmen, very high demand, low density skill set. SAR swimmers, another one. We in the reserves are looking to, in the case of the Aegis fire controlmen, maintain those folks in the reserve status so that they can go out and support our large number of Aegis ships, whether that's weekend sort of maintenance or short-term exercises or longer-term sets of orders. We're now using something called ADOS app, which is fairly new, the Navy Reserve Active Duty Operational Support. The other services have used it. So that's one way we're getting people out to sea as much as possible. And then, you know, the Reserve still has some of those unique capabilities that aren't resident on the active side. So on the air side, for example, we've got our C-40 squadrons, basically 737 cargo transport planes that are flown. A lot of those pilots on the Reserve side fly the same platform in their day job as airline pilots, and they've got just thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of very, very experienced pilots. Same thing on the aggressor squadrons that we have, the aggressor wing for the Navy Reserve. So we still have a pretty significant air side and surface side. The one topic that always gets tossed around is Navy Reserve ships. You know, back when I first got in the Navy and when you guys were on active duty in the 80s and 90s, we had a number of FFTs, the Fast Frigate Training Reserve variants. We had USS John F. Kennedy, which was actually a reserve carrier. That program, you know, it went away, and I'm not sure we need to bring it back. We've got reservists that are assigned, like I mentioned, to the LCS squadrons where they can get on and do watch standing and maintenance and augment those ships, whether it's while they're in port or out on deployment or support maintenance teams for deployed. So we're going to continue to strive to find the balance and hope we get it right.
Yeah, and there's specialized teams too that will provide ad hoc support. I think of the team that the divers that went out almost, I think, within 48 hours. Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, to help out the Argentine Navy with the loss of their submarine when they were looking for it. You know, to be able to deploy people quickly with a specialty, it is extraordinary, and it's one of the ways that the Navy Reserve does do some things really, really well.
Yeah,
well,
the submarine rescue capability is very reserve-centric.
That does raise one of the complaints that we used to hear when I was in the reserves was it took, you know, you talk to a potential gaining commander, they say it just takes too much work to get you guys here. That there's a timeliness factor, and maybe I haven't been paying attention over the last few years, but has that problem been resolved? Is that, or is it in the process of being resolved?
I'd say that kind of waxes and wanes. For example, my first reserve mobilization, I was called on a Friday to report to San Diego on that Sunday, and then I was in Kuwait the following Thursday, and then, you know, eventually ended up in Iraq for OIF-1. Now it's a little bit more predictable. You get some heads up that you're going to be mobilized, hopefully at least 6 months, and you can plan your life around it. It's still, you know, being a reservist is a tough job because you've got this balancing act between your civilian job, your Navy Reserve job, and your family. And most of our reservists do a really good job at it, but it is, I mean, the family support is amazing that people who go out there I'll speak for myself, for most, and a lot of the senior folks I know that have been around a while, the Navy Reserve is your hobby. Don't necessarily watch a lot of sports or do a lot of things because your weekends, one or more weekends a month are taken up with traveling for the Navy, and we do it because we love it and we have a passion for it.
Yeah, Chris is right. That's why we got into it. And I share that with Chris because after 9/11, I think it took them about – once they had the presidential authorization, it took us about a day and a half to mobilize. They called me up and said, okay, you ready to go? I said, yep, ready to go. And the support services that exist today I don't think were as robust as they were in 2001. That's one thing that I was pretty impressed with going out and coming back. You know, just all the information you kind of need. But they do stress, the Navy Reserve does stress, like, almost every weekend, are you ready on a moment's notice to go? So that's why we're always going over to medical to make sure that our records are up to date. Why GMT, as much as we may hate Tina staring over the partition at the desk when we're doing the cyber awareness training, you know, that's the stuff you just don't want to do, but you know that you just want all the green lights so that you and the others who are serving under you or with you are ready to go. So that is a good thing that the Navy Reserve has done really well in preparing us to say, you've got to go at some point, get ready to go.
So just a,
well, I was going to follow up and ask about, has the process of getting you to where you're going been sped up? When I got mobilized to go to Kosovo, actually in Southcom, it was a nightmare. I mean, it was one of those things where you sit around and wait for you know, and I was ready to go. You know, mm-hmm. Has that been sped up? Has that process been fixed?
Yeah.
It has. Yeah. You know, we've done enough iterations, tens of thousands mm-hmm. of iterations since 9/11 of getting people on orders that we can do it. And the short of mobilizing, there's a lot of other situations, I can name three off the top of my head, that we bring reservists on active duty in a very rapid manner for contingency. So a couple of examples, the Haiti earthquake response, I think, what was that, 2010, the Lebanese evacuation, 2006, Tomodachi, which was the nuclear accident in northern Japan, whenever that was. So those are the types of things where you will get a lot of reservists, and a lot of times, you know, standing up a JTF or some sort of task force, and many times the active duty folks don't even realize that they just think you're TAD from somewhere. They don't know that you're a reservist, and that's the way it should be. We should be able to seamlessly integrate our reservists into these ad hoc or permanent staffs or missions. And that's one thing reservists are really good at, is because you do move around a lot and you do serve on a lot of different exercises. You can take an average reservist and dump them onto a task force or staff, and he or she will perform pretty well.
Yeah, another way that I think we've improved is tweaking the system. There is a portal called Ready to Win on the Navy Reserve website. And what that is if you have an idea about how to fix something, it might be simple, a moderate issue, a larger issue, you can post it up there. And all the other reservists who are interested can comment on it, good for good and ill. They will give a thumbs up or thumbs down. You will see how you'll see it tracking to see generally if it's good. It's like crowdsourcing an idea. And in some cases, you know, Navy Reserve will implement them if they see that, hey, this is doable. It's an easy fix. So the communication has certainly improved over the past 17 years as well.
Yeah, Chris, I had a little bit of a grin on my face when you were talking about how quickly you deployed. And I think often we always need to remember that if the balloon goes up, things can change rather fast. I remember right after 9/11, reading a message over at Fifth Fleet for that gave permission to people to bring their personal firearms with them because they couldn't get enough M9s. We had people showing up with, you know, Kimber custom 45s. It was actually kind of funny.
Yeah,
but,
Sal, that was that was, I'll tell you, I was actually working on Capitol Hill for my second senator in 2004, and she was on the Armed Services Committee, and we were, I was getting feedback from folks in the field, folks that I had served with. We were getting reports from the state of reservists who had deployed. And, yeah, supplies, ammunition, food, everything you can think of were problems that had to be solved. And I think that's not the case today as it was for, 15 years ago.
Yeah, we're slowly getting there. Let's pull the thread, because one of the interesting parts of the article you wrote, Claude, was it rhymed with a common question that I ask here on a variety of subjects. You know, who are our advocates on the Hill? Or if we can't get the Navy bureaucracy to do things one way, can we find congressional action to force mode change? And you brought up, and I was hoping you could outline for the listener, the fact that Congress has significant levers that they mm-hmm. can use to move reserve policies in ways that can make things move a lot faster than people might think otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the tweaks earlier for changing, improving issues within the Navy Reserve. The Navy Reserve has the ability to do that. But if you're talking wholesale reform, it's not necessarily the role or the statutory role of the USNR to make those changes, nor would it be from the active component Navy. Changes have to come. They must come from the originating authority, and that's Congress. I mean, you can go right back to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. But they are the ones who created the Department of the Navy. They created the Navy Reserve, as a result of World War I. They are the ones who modified it. So if you're going to see reform and what the Navy's role in the 21st century with regard to peer competitors in a maritime environment, that really can only come from Congress. Question is, you're right, who will take lead? There is a Navy Reserve Caucus. I don't know if I've gotten that exact title right. I think so. It's called something else. But the folks on there would be obviously a logical choice. Folks on the sea power subcommittees of the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee, those would be logical choices as well. But this may not be on the radar, to be quite frank. Look, when it's not like it was 2004 and 2005, they were considering increasing the size of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to include the Army National Guard. I think that's right, Chris, right? It was the Army National Guard that came in, not the Army Reserves. And they had a seat at the table. Nobody was talking about the Navy Reserve having a seat at the table. The reason why is because you had so many Army Reservists, Army National Guard going to Iraq and Afghanistan at that point, and the numbers of the Navy Reservists didn't merit that. So there have been changes on the Hill with regard to recognizing reserve or guard units, but not necessarily for the Navy. When they are testifying, it's largely the active component that's testifying.
Yeah, Claude, that was actually National Guard Bureau, which is Air Force and
thank you
for Air National Guard and Army National Guard of all the states. But I don't think you're wrong.
That's the question you kind of ask at the end of your article, Claude. If we are getting away, if we want the Navy Reserve to go back to doing maritime operation missions, what do we need to change to make that happen?
That would really be wholesale change in several communities. It would be probably a reinvestment, which people may not necessarily want to do. We don't necessarily want to go to where we had the reserve frigates, for example. But, you know, there may be an opportunity here with what I mentioned earlier with regard to the Army decreasing by about 80% its watercraft. Is that something that we could do? I mean, there are plenty of SWOs out there who are reservists. There are plenty of folks like me who are craft masters who have qualified for small boats. So we could look at logistics. We could look at what Chris has done. Maritime partnerships are fantastic. And the nice thing about maritime partnerships is, you know, whether it's the Gulf of Guinea or somewhere else, a lot of reservists are actually geared on that. You have people who work for State Department. You have people who work for large and small corporations. You have people who work for non-governmental organizations who are in the reserves who could easily fit in and work with these people. These are people who have lived overseas before, where you may not have a 24 or 25-year-old SWO as qualified as they are to drive the ships. They may not have lived in another country necessarily. There are some, obviously. You could look at focusing on humanitarian relief efforts with regard to supporting either we've got a couple of hospital ships, but you could have smaller – I've talked about this before in another magazine, but looking at more commercialized, smaller hospital ships that can go into smaller areas that the current two ships that we have would not be able to go into those ports. Even NGOs like Mercy Ships, they run one to three ships. You could look at efforts in countering peer competitors. You know, look, I'm not a China expert. I don't know if China has a Navy reserve. So they're certainly got enough people, and their Navy is large enough. I think they've built, 30 ships in the past 5 years. They've got a large enough Navy, they may not need a Navy reserve. However, and I think Andrew Erickson's been on the show before. Is that correct, Sal?
Correct.
Yeah, he has.
Okay. So when he's talking about the maritime militias, they are a essentially, if I were to – Andrew, I hope Andrew's listening and can correct me. They are essentially serving as an auxiliary of the Navy, that is a Navy reserve, a non-uniformed one, but still one that has received training, has mission. So we could look at, potentially smaller operations in the maritime environment like that, where the Navy, the active component of the Navy, isn't necessarily looking at or can't invest in because they have a lot of missions, quite frankly. So.
The kind of open the aperture a little bit here, going back to something we mentioned earlier, and Chris, I'd be interested to get your take on this. The larger Navy conversation, again, talking about the peer and the near peer. If you have a contested conflict at sea in 5 months, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and if you look at, you know, what are those things that we may not need on a day-to-day basis in the active force, but on, you know, from day plus one on, you're going to be starving for any type of extended conflict. First things that come to my mind are the logistics, both and sea lift, airlift, but also, as we have done in previous wars, you're going to have various facilities and distribution hubs. But also, what comes to mind is something Claude touches on a little bit in his article, the basics of having additional watch standards. When I was a kid, now I'm no longer in the middle of nowhere, but there's a little fish camp halfway down the St. John's River called Piccolotta Point. And the guy who owned it, behind the counter, he had epoxy on top of a map that he kept from when he was on he was on a DD during the Second World War. And from the time he got on board to the end of the war, over a three-year period, besides going in for a little bit of refit here and there, they were at sea constantly, something that is not a regular habit for our Navy. You know, when you look at what those requirements might be, what are some of those areas that, because we haven't had to in the last 15 years, that even without additional resources or funding, that our Naval Reserve component might be able to refocus on to better address that challenge, if that's the one we should most likely be exerting our efforts towards?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you looked at our current force structure, if something were to happen, we've got these bodies with really diverse, these sailors with really diverse backgrounds. and experiences both on the civilian side and Navy side. And so things like watch standing are, that's a no brainer. And we're doing that all the time. And we practice doing that all the time via the numbered fleets, the exercise support, that sort of thing. And if you look at like a globally distributed sort of fight, you're going to need, like you said, small austere locations. And we've got reservists that can do that and that are doing that now. If you look at, just for example, JTF Horn of Africa, there's cooperative security locations where the OIC is a Navy reservist, and you know, the CDs go in, set those up. In some cases, they're reservists. And we could do a lot of that any place in the world that we needed. And you have capabilities like Coastal Riverine. So you've got, you can put those together with CBs and do what we call adaptive force packages. And I'd like to see more of that. I'd like to see more, a little bit more, when we talk about distributed lethality, that tends to be discussed in terms of at sea. But I think shore is where we really need to focus on it, on the logistics side and the intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance side, and the ability to put fires ashore from austere locations and move them and really confuse the enemy and make it a more difficult targeting situation for a potential enemy.
Just to add on to what Chris just said, Silent Eagle One, I would add that, look, during World War II or any other war, the ships were far different than what they are today. They are far more complex, require far more lead time to get all the components. You know, an Aegis-equipped destroyer, Arleigh Burke, is, what, about 5+ years to construct? You could probably truncate that, maybe, but we don't have the industrial base that we had during World War II. We don't have the number of shipyards that we had during World War II. So if you have anything but – if you really extend a maritime conflict and there are heavy losses at the beginning, you're going to have a very difficult problem in backfilling that with reservists or, more importantly, ships. What you could do, and Chris alluded to, is this distributed network of smaller, differently capable ships. And I alluded to that in a National Interest article I wrote about 2 years ago now called Trump's Gunboats. What I suggested was, if you wanted to increase the size of the Navy, you go small. You continue to build big, but you have these small, lower-cost platforms that you could build practically anywhere when you looked at the current industrial base. And that included along the Mississippi River, included the Great Lakes, both coasts. There are commercial ships out there that can be used for patrol, for reconnaissance. And if there are states or organizations doing that, and I think of the specifically of the Daman shipyard built ships that are providing either maritime security support in the Gulf of Guinea. One of them was built for Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which we've talked about on this show before, and which Chris and I have written about. So you have these capable platforms for a potential variety of missions that would be very low cost, and you could build a number of them. Granted, we still have these major investments called carriers, cruisers, and destroyers and submarines by necessity, and we are struggling to make sure that those numbers improve. And I'm looking forward to a Heritage talk, and I think it's next Monday, correct me if I'm wrong, where Jerry Hendricks and Brian McGrath and others who have been on the show before are going to discuss the budget issues. But one thing that always gets neglected out of the budget issues are the low-end platforms. And also, you know, and I mentioned in this particular article, regular warfare. It was around for a bit, but the Naval Irregular Warfare Office went away. And again, that's something that, you know, maybe the reserves could pick up that mission if the active duty Navy is prohibited simply because of the number of missions that they're attending to.
It's an interesting question because, of course, the Trump gunboat was a brilliant article. I remember your co-author quite well.
You did it. Yes, I have to say that Eagle One and I co-authored that article.
Oh, did we? they used to have these mine units in the reserves, where they had what they called coop craft taken up from, they were craft of opportunity. So they would use some small ship boat for mine sweeping in harbors and stuff. I don't know what it cost, but it went away fairly quickly. I don't think it's got the notoriety it should have, but it does raise the question now with these distributed autonomous or semi-autonomous systems for mine hunting and all that stuff. Should the reserves be focusing on these and more focused on some of these things that would enhance their capability of helping and augmenting the active force?
Yeah, I think for sure. And if you look at, specifically, you mentioned mine warfare and more of that is being pushed over to the unmanned side. And there are reservists that are focused on that unmanned community on the air side. We've got a lot of Scan Eagle sorts of debts that are being led by reserve naval aviators, and Naval Special Warfare has got some Scan Eagle capabilities that run on the reserve side. But I think you could do the same thing on the surface side. As we look at the new larger unmanned surface vessels coming online, the active duty side is standing up something called the Surf Devron, or Surface Development Squadron, which is going to basically take control of these, figure out how we can best use and experiment with these unmanned surface vessels. And I think that's a great place. In fact, I know we're actually in discussions with getting some reserve involvement in that community, and I'm looking forward to that.
I'm a big fan of The Cruel Sea, one of the best Navy movies ever made. And the one fun thing about watching all of those old British World War II movies is if you pay attention to uniform details, it's like, okay, somebody has a very thick gold braid, somebody has wiggly gold braid, somebody has thin wiggly gold braid. The Royal Navy has a tradition of, you got the Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve, the Royal Navy Reserve. And as such, and maybe, Chris or Claude, whoever would want to jump in first, it's always good not just to look at what we've done internally, but also externally. Have we had a chance to look at navies of a similar cultural background, what comes to mind, the British, the Dutch, the French, maybe even the Spanish or the Norwegians, how they utilize or don't utilize their reserve forces that might be something that would be worth looking at, or do they do things similar to us that just reinforces that we are doing something right?
So I've been in reserves almost 20 years now, and I know we do have these liaison opportunities with the UK and elsewhere, but I can honestly say I have never heard of any kind of report coming back saying, hey, this is how they do things. Wouldn't it be great if we do this? When we worked with we had French midshipmen come over to the Naval Academy about 10 years ago when I was on one of the yard YPs, or the yard patrol craft that you take, 30 mids out for 3 weeks during the summer. And, speaking of uniforms, I was just kind of struck by their uniform. They actually had a couple of stripes, the reflective stripes, and I think just about that time the blueberries were coming out, and I said, we could do things like the French in this case, or working with our Royal Navy liaison, how they were doing things. I think absolutely we should be, I think it's to our detriment that we don't engage more if we don't with our counterparts in other Navy reserves to see how they are doing things. But I just haven't seen any kind of feedback where we improved anything as a result. I may be wrong, and so I'll turn it over to Chris, who obviously had some different insight too.
Yeah, my experience, say the NATO navies, I spent a lot of time in Africa my last job, and there was on the exercises we'd see NATO officers, naval officers over there, and used in a very similar capacity to what we were using. But keep in mind, those navies are small. Their Navy reserve compared to us, and their Navy reserves are tiny, tiny. So I'm not sure it's a great comparison, but I'm always for looking at best practices and applying them mm-hmm. wherever they're from.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I had the chance to when you're in the old naval control and protection of shipping world, or whatever it's called now, the Brits took that on, and it is a very much a NATO function, and we closed all our units that as far as I know, reserve units used to handle that stuff, which were used to be fairly large units and a place to stash a lot of officers. But they're in talking to those British Royal Navy reservists, you know, they were not looked well upon by their active duty compatriots, because their mission was to do the things that the active duty guys didn't want to do, and that was and they didn't go to sea very much and all that stuff. So I think you're right. It's a very difficult comparison, but in addition to which, I think the Royal Navy is now probably smaller than our Naval Reserve.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's funny, because I you know, you do get a sense of that. I mean, heck, you remember the old Simpsons episode, which had Homer Simpson joining the Navy Reserve, and the term Navy Reserve America's 17th line of defense came out, and people wondered what the Navy Reserve did. But, you know, on the active assignments that I've had in working with some of the folks that I have, when you see them on a day-to-day basis for 6 months, a year, I think the active component gets a different perspective on the capabilities that the individuals coming in, whether it's individual augmentees or whatever, bring to the table. They see that, yeah, this is somebody who's willing to work. This is somebody who knows their stuff. Now, that I'm painting a very large picture. That in any organization, you're going to get people who aren't capable, who aren't doing the job. But overall, if given the opportunity, I think folks have stepped up to the plate, especially the past 17 years, and demonstrated what you can do. And heck, you could look at the president. So the first line in the article, the Naval Reserve had 5 presidents plus one who went from USN to USNR.
And as we look forward, I thought just a great figure you put out there is talk a bit about the Naval Reserve as a percentage of that great United States Navy, be it the Japanese in the Pacific. That's a pretty powerful number.
Yeah, the 90% that is composed of the Navy as a whole, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But again, you were in a war that was wholesale, that was total war. Everybody who could be was involved. We're not in that kind of environment. We haven't been in that environment in the past 17 years where everybody who could be drafted is. We don't obviously not have a draft anymore. But you don't have the industrial base, which has been completely geared toward war for Iraq or Afghanistan, or I should say Afghanistan now and some other places. But it's simply changed. You have an all-volunteer force. You have an all-volunteer Navy Reserve. And it's simply different than it was back in 1941 and 42 or back in 1917. And that's understandable. But there's going to come a time, as history shows, where we will probably be in a much larger conflict.
Yeah, I think one of the great strengths of the Navy Reserve, having spent, I don't know, 23 years in it after 7 years on active duty, is the how well-rounded the reservists are. You know, these are usually mature individuals who've done other things in their lives. They bring a wealth of experience to the job, and they're not limited to what they learned at A school or whatever. They've learned a whole lot more about life and about how to do other things. So you may have a bosun mate who is excellent air conditioning repairman. It just works out that way. It's a great thing.
That's true. And actually, before Eagle One, I'll give you one example because of this weekend. Lieutenant Commander Chris Macaluso, U.S. Navy Reserve. Chris had started off as a Marine. He became a Vermont State Trooper when I knew him, when he was a direct commission. He and I commissioned at the same time, went to DCO school together, and we were both 33 when we got our commissions. And Chris went on to a lengthy service with NCIS and retired finally medically about a year or so ago. Chris passed away on Friday, but he was a great American who believed in doing his duty, whether back for the Marines or law enforcement, but brought this breadth of experience to the Navy Reserve and this leadership and this maturity that we all relied on. And you see this every day with the people you work with. I saw it down in Guantanamo Bay. You know, particularly the officers that I left, and the enlisted that I saw, the Navy enlisted, were just spectacular because they were older, more mature, more experienced, had gone and done things before.
Yep, I'll
yeah.
Let me, I mean, the people I work with in Navy Reserve are you know, some of the best friends and best people I've ever known and worked with, and it's just amazing that the talent we have resident in the force.
And I think that, you know, that goes to also how folks are used and matching skill sets to the jobs at hand. We could have a whole different discussion on that, but I alluded to it in the article, but it's something we might want to take a look at in the future as well.
Let me thank both of you gentlemen for coming on today. I think we could talk much more about the reserves. I'm not sure everybody who is knows enough about how active and how important the reserves are. It's really been great having you guys on. So thank you. And I should also say, because I'm going to be taking about 6 or 7 months off from this show to do some random things. But so Sal will be saddled with a guest host who will probably take my place by being far superior to me. But I've really enjoyed the last few years and talking to guys like you. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Galen.
Thanks.
And thanks, gentlemen, very much for joining us for another edition of Midrats. One thing we almost forgot to do before we close up today. I know both of y'all are pretty active on Twitter, but you also write on a regular basis. If the listeners wanted to keep track of what you're up to, Chris, let's start with you, then over to Claude. Where should they keep an eye open for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm not writing much anymore, but I'll say my plug, if there's any active duty junior officers getting off and deciding whether or not they want to join the reserves, hit me up on the Global. I'd love to talk to you or put you in touch with someone younger who can speak better than I can.
And you can follow me on Twitter at CG Barraby, and I'm currently doing the final edits on my sixth book. It's a change from my dissertation on Andrew Jackson's Navy. That'll be published by University of Alabama Press. So I was hoping later this year, but probably next year. And in the meantime, now that I'm back from deployment, I'm looking forward to writing more for War on the Rocks as a contributing editor.
Outstanding, guys. A pleasure as always to have you on MedRats, and look forward to having you all on again sometime again in the future.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
And just a note for those that join the program for Eagle One. He's not going to retreat to some Buddhist monastery in the mountains of Burma. I don't know if his knees could take the hike up, but Eagle One, it's been a pleasure to have a constant companion with you here, but we're not going to replace you with a sports car and somebody half my age. So we'll see your established wisdom when you get back from your walkabout, and I'll look forward to it, and thank you very much.
Yeah, I should note, too, that I will be occasionally calling in randomly on the Sundays to make fun of whoever is guest hosting and keep my hand in. I'm not losing contact with the rest of the world. I just have something else I urgently need to do. So, anyway, thank you, Sal.
You're welcome, and we look forward to you calling in and putting us on the report. It's always good. And thanks, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And if you've been with us this long, you're obviously a fan of the show. And if you want to help other people to discover MidRats, one of the best things you can do, go ahead and run over to iTunes or Google Play, wherever you listen to us. Give us a 5-star like and subscribe to the podcast when people scan it for national security-related stuff. They can always find us here. So, hey, we'll see y'all in a few weeks. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.